I love to talk to people who are a bit older and to hear their memories of the past. Because often certain things have stuck in their minds that are absolutely striking. And they remember that amongst hundreds, thousands of other events. There's certain events that just so stick in their minds. I remember talking to one man who's since died about his time in the Second World War when he was I think ARP type things. And he was just in the absolute darkness, and he saw a lot of people cycling towards him rapidly, and they just missed him. And you can just imagine this situation, blackout time, everyone comes around him. It etched on his memory. That's just the only memory I think he gave me of the entirety of World War II, this memory of nearly being hit by people at night as a boy. And we need to remind ourselves that when Matthew is giving this gospel, as in the other gospels, he's giving eyewitness testimony. Remember what John said in his gospel, that if all the things that Jesus had done were written down, he supposed that the whole world would not be big enough for the things that had been written. So what has been written down must have been the most striking things of a man who did a huge number of extraordinary things. And it's significant the way this passage is structured. Have you noticed that in the passage we've got something that happened to an individual? That's verses 21 to 28. And we get a conversation. Then we get the bit that today you'd have had all the news crews for. Verses 29 to 31, the mass healings, is just kind of summary. And then again, the news crews would be quite interested in the summary from verses 36 to 39, which is given in generic terms. But the bit that's focused in the first section, which we're going to spend the majority of our time on this morning, is a conversation. A striking conversation. An unusual conversation. It's got some similarities in terms of the unusual way that Jesus is acting to what happened when he received news that Lazarus was ill. Do you remember that in John's Gospel, chapter 11? When Jesus heard that his dear friend Lazarus was sick, he went and saw him immediately? No. He stayed where he was 2 days. And just as John remembers that distinctly and describes it in detail in John 11. So Matthew remembers this conversation backwards and forwards with this woman. Imagine Matthew listening on, taking part to an extent, and saying, what is happening here? Now, we could just say, well, Jesus is obviously, in using modern terms, he's obviously a racist because he's calling the Gentiles dogs. He's obviously a chauvinist because he's calling a woman a dog. And he's obviously horrible because he's making both points in public. Is that what we're to conclude? Well, that's not what we're here to conclude, because we need to remember that Jesus is acting in character. Sometimes we don't always understand what God's doing. There's a lovely hymn. God shall alone the refuge be, and comfort of my mind. And what's the two lines that keep being repeated there? Too wise to be mistaken he, too good to be unkind. Too wise to be mistaken, too good to be unkind. And we need to remember that in the dealings we have with God. He's too wise to be mistaken, he's too good to be unkind. And therefore, we need to understand somewhere else, from the scriptures, what is going on. And I would suggest to you that there's a strong parallel between what happens here and what happened in that passage in John 11. Because in the passage in John 11, Jesus was absolutely explicit with the reason why he stayed where he was 2 days and allowed Lazarus to die when he could have healed him. Jesus states it in John chapter 11, verse 15. He says, I'm glad I was not there so that what? You may believe. Jesus acted in a certain way to draw out faith in his disciples in resurrection. And remember, John was there, and therefore when John came to the empty tomb with never seeing the risen Christ, he saw and he believed. That was effective in encouraging faith. And this story, this account of this conversation, climaxes in verse 28. And what's the climax? O woman, great is your faith. Jesus is acting in the same way as he does in John 11 to build up faith. But there's something more there. It's not just he's showing faith, he's showing Gentile faith. And I speak this morning as one dog to another lot of dogs, that we, by birth, I don't know where of any Jews here, there may be some who I don't know, but one dog to another dog, we are strangers to the covenants of promise, outside of Israel. That's what we are by nature. So despite many of our familiarities with the Bible, we need to remember which side of the fence we are as we read this story. And this story should say, is there any hope for dogs like me? Dogs like you. And Jesus says, yes. Yes, there is. Yes, there is. And that's what we're going to be seeing here this morning. Hope for dogs like us. Or put it more positively, the Messiah to the Jews is the Messiah for the Gentiles. The Father sent his Son to be the Savior of the world. And he's the one to whom we can come. So we'll see at greater length Christ's heart for a Gentile individual. That's verses 21 to 28. And then Christ's heart for the Gentile crowds. That's verses 29 to 39. But the majority of our time we're going to spend on this striking conversation. Christ's heart for a Gentile individual. Now the context of this account is quite significant. So remember what we've seen already in recent weeks. We've seen Jesus hearing that Herod felt he was John the Baptist raised from the dead, and Herod wanted to see him. And Jesus had travelled across the Lake Galilee, he'd gone east, and he'd gone out of Herod's territory. He'd fed 5,000 Jews, and then it seems, if you compare to John, they wanted to make him king. He'd left there, he'd gone back to the east, there'd been some healing. Then he'd had this account when the delegation had come from Jerusalem, asked him about clean and unclean, and Jesus had said, uncleanness comes from inside. We sin because we're already sinners. And at this point, Jesus has continued his departure. The kind of movement back into Herod's territory has just been by way of going through. Because in verse 21, what do we read? Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. Now, those of you who are not aware of biblical geography, that means he heads west to the coast. Tyre and Sidon are ports. Now, Tyre is 25 miles north, and there's another 25 miles north to Sidon. He'd be walking. This could be months spent in Gentile territory. And this is significant. This is the Messiah who came to save his people from their sins in his only recorded departure during his ministry from biblical Israel. He's outside of the territory, outside of historic biblical Israel. And Matthew really emphasizes this. Look how verse 22 starts. He doesn't say, and a Canaanite woman met him. He says, and behold, a Canaanite. Look, a Canaanite. This word only occurs once in the New Testament. A Canaanite. What would a Jew be thinking of Canaanite? Well, they would think evil. Terrible morals. Do you remember in Genesis, what did the Canaanites do? Corrupted Jacob's family. Think about when they came into the promised land. What were they told to do to the Canaanites? Utterly destroy them. These are the enemies of God's people. Not just people outside of God's people, but opposed to God's people, of loose morals. And here we have Jesus showcasing her faith. And some might say, well, hang on a second, I thought that Matthew was a gospel to the Jews. I thought this was a Jewish gospel. Well, how does Matthew start? Matthew chapter 1. We have a family tree. And who does Matthew highlight within the family tree? Tamar. Canaanite woman, Jesus' ancestor. Rahab, Canaanite woman, Jesus' ancestor. Matthew has already set the seeds for this in drawing Jesus' human genealogy to his adopted father. And he has said, as we've been seeing again and again as we look at Matthew and Acts as well, that the gospel is for Jew first, but also for the Greek. It's coming out from the Jews to the Gentiles. Jesus enables Israel to fulfill the mission that it's always had, to bring the gospel to the world. Well, as this passage goes on, we hear the word answer four times. And it seems to me that this passage is structured around that word. And so we'll see Jesus' response to this woman in four ways. And we'll see in there some lessons about how sometimes he might respond to us, to draw out our faith as he's drawn out this woman's faith. Well, the first place we see answer is in verse 23, when it's just no answer. That's the first thing. No answer, no answer at all. Behold, it says here, verse 22, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying. Remember, Matthew's watching this. This wailing woman approaches. Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon. But he did not answer her a word. Now, Matthew's remembering what she said. This woman, this wailing woman, has come on there outside of Israel, territory of Israel. Obviously not got the huge crowds at this stage. This woman comes out, they see her. And Matthew must have been struck by what she said. I mean, look what she's saying. O Lord, O Son of David. She's saying, you are the Jewish Messiah. And she's trusting in him. O Lord. So Tyre and Sidon had their territorial gods. That's how the Gentiles have understood it. We've got our gods of our territory. You Jews have got the gods of your territory. But this woman comes crying out and says, no, the true God is Israel's Messiah. She's deliberately used two Jewish titles. What humility. What faith. But he did not answer her a word. Too wise to be mistaken, he. Too good to be unkind. The lack of answer, is if we just saw that in art, we'd think, what's going on? Too wise to be mistaken, he. Too good to be unkind. Christ is acting in that way quite deliberately. And one lesson we can draw is this, simply. Have you ever prayed something and not had an instant answer? I'm guessing every believer here has prayed something and not had an instant answer. And we need to be reminding ourselves that Christ's silences are loving silences. They're wise silences. They're not there to be cruel. They're there to increase our faith and to draw it out and to increase dependence upon him. So don't be discouraged if the first time you pray, you don't get the answer you seek. There's nothing wrong with this woman's sincerity, but Christ is responding to her in love. Well, you might say, okay, fine, so far, no answer. He's going to put her out of her misery. But no, we go from no answer to a distant answer. A distant answer. Look again at verse 23. But he did not answer her a word, and his disciples came and begged him, saying, send her away, for she's crying out after us. He answered, not the woman, but the disciples. I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. I mean, this really is really making a point, isn't it? When you talk about someone, not to them. This is, most people with any kind of social nous would think, well, that's a bit of a strong point. Quite a strong point. Because my parents might use and talk to each other by saying something in front of their children to make a point. That kind of idea. But let's first of all, before we come to that in more detail, work out what's happening with the disciples. So at first glance, the disciples seem to be pretty negative about this woman at all. Send her away. Send her away. But they're not calling her a dog. They say, send her away, for she's crying out after us. And if we look in how that word send away, a verb send, is used in different contexts. For example, Luke chapter 14, verse 4, it describes a man, and it says this. He took him and healed him and sent him away. So the sent away implication is Jesus, just get on with it. Get rid of this demon and send her away. I mean, you remember for the disciples, Jesus healing and casting out demons is utterly routine. It seems incredible to us, doesn't it? But the disciples have been witnessing Jesus' utterly incredible power for a long time now. And the people come up to Jesus and they're healed. Someone else comes up, they're healed. Someone else comes up, they're healed. Someone comes up with a demon, he casts it out. And again, and again, and again. And they're saying, Jesus, look, you've got the power. And he'd given some of the power, hadn't he, to the disciples. They'd been on a mission trip for him. And they cast out demons and sent people away. So the disciples saying to Jesus, just get on with it. What are you waiting for? Send her away. Heal her and we won't have her crying out. It could well be that they've never ever seen Christ send anyone away unhealed. There's no evidence, is there, in the Gospels of any person coming to Christ for healing who was sent away unhealed. We also need to think here that when Matthew records this, we can't hear Christ's tone of voice and we can't read his body language. We know the woman's listening in and we know the words are meant for her as the conversation goes on. And it could well be that it's like this. You know, sometimes, and I've noticed from a pastor as a teacher, someone will give an answer and the teacher might respond, oh, come on, you can't really believe that, can you? That's ridiculous. And they will argue back. And then the teacher will argue back, and they'll argue back. And it's a deliberate device to try and draw them out. And we don't know whether the woman read some of that into this. I'm not saying it was definitely there, but I think we've just got to be careful that we read these verses and we allow the full range of potential body language and tone of voice to have to play. Okay, because we know what Jesus is doing. Jesus, too wise to be mistaken, too good to be unkind, is acting to draw out her faith. That when he gives this distant answer, when it's an answer she hears about her rather than to her, he's doing it to draw her out and to draw her faith out in him. And again, we might hear distant answers. We might hear someone talking about what God's done for them. I want to say, but I'm also one of God's people. Why doesn't he answer my prayers as he answers their prayers? They're talking about him. I'd love to have more of that experience. And Christ would say, trust me. Keep coming to me. Keep depending upon me. Well, we have no answer. Then we have a distant answer. And then we have a direct but negative answer. A negative answer. What do we see this woman do? Verse 25, remember Matthew remembering this. She came and knelt before him, saying, Lord, help me. This wailing woman's come right up to him. And that's why I'm suggesting there may be something in the body language or the tone of voice, because this woman is not discouraged to come near. She comes right up to him. The idea maybe means she's crying out after them from some distance to start with. Do you remember Bartimaeus? Son of David, have mercy on me at a distance. But this woman is now, she's come right in. She's kneeling. Her whole body language is pleading. Her words say, Lord, help me. And again, we might say, well, Jesus, okay, we've gone far enough now. We've had the ignoring, no answer. We've had the distant answer. Now, surely she's now kneeling before you. She's demonstrating a faith, a Jew, a Gentile standing before a Jew who's already referred to her as a dog. Not put off, she says, help me. Surely, Jesus, you will now heal her. Obviously, no. How does Jesus respond? It is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. You see, the previous statement that Jesus made, you might say, well, that's factually accurate. I mean, he was sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He wasn't sent to Rome, the center of civilization at the time. He wasn't sent to an intellectual capital, Athens. He wasn't sent to a place where there were loads more Jews than in some parts of Israel, Alexandria, another big port. He was sent to Israel. He had a particular mission to go to his people as a messenger of the covenant. He came to save his people from their sins. We can say, okay, I understand the previous answer. That makes some theological sense. The woman needs to understand the priority of the Jews. But this seems not just priority of the Jews. This seems exclusivity of the Jews. It is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. I think the only way we can understand this, unless we think that Jesus is being deliberately harsh, is he's deliberately pressing home his point to the stage of apparent rudeness and cruelty to draw her out still further. Does Jesus read the heart? Yes. So does Jesus know she's going to go away crying? He knows she's not going to go away crying. He's acting because he reads the heart. And surely that's got to encourage us that when he deals with us, he knows our hearts, he knows our frame, he remembers we are dust, he's compassionate, he's merciful, that when he's acting in a way to draw our faith, he won't push us beyond more than we can bear. He's always going to act in a loving, kind manner. And now we come to the fourth type of answer. We've had no answer, we've had a distant answer, we've had a negative answer. And finally we come to a rewarding answer. A rewarding answer. And this woman, she would say, well, it's worth it all for this answer. I mean, what an incredible answer. Jesus answered her, verse 27. She said, yes, Lord, even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. Then Jesus answered her, oh woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire. And her daughter was healed instantly. Now we have in these women's words an answer of incredible faith. Remember what Jesus has done prior to this account. He's highlighted that the issue is not uncleanness on the outside, it's sin on the inside. And the Jews, the Pharisees, thinking they're very proud and I've got the right pedigree socially, genetically, in every single religious way, they didn't get anything from Jesus. They didn't get any commendation. They didn't show this faith. But this woman has shown that she deserves nothing. Nothing. She said, look, if you just give me a few crumbs, that'll be enough. A few crumbs to come from the family table. And she's saying, I want to be in. Let me in any possible way. If I could just get in that house. You remember, think about the prodigal returning. What does he say? Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm not worthy to be called your son. Make me one of your hired servants. She's saying, look, I want to be in to God's family. I can't be in by my pedigree. I'm a Gentile. I can't get in as one of the children. But if I could just get in as a dog. It's this thing we've seen in the Old Testament. I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of God than dwell in tents of sin. It's any way in possible. I've got to get in. Let me in. Do you remember Jesus said that people took the kingdom by force? They're absolutely desperate to be saved. Desperate. They'll accept anything about themselves if I can only come in. Let me ask you this morning, how strongly do you feel your sin? I'm not saying, would you agree with me if I say, well, no one's perfect and we all do things wrong. That's true. But do you feel your sin? Do you feel your sin is so strong that it would exclude you and put you out from the presence of God for eternity? Such that any possible way of escaping eternal hell and getting into heaven, even if you're kind of the guest at the wedding on table 47 in the corner, and you're thinking, there, I'd like to be there. Well, not even like the guest at the table. If I can just sit under the table and see if the guests are dropping anything for me. Any way in, I'm not worthy of anything. That is the attitude of this woman. And that's why Jesus says, great is your faith. May it be done for you as you desire. He's saying to this woman, you understand what it's like of your unworthiness. And you understand of my worthiness. But not just my worthiness, my willingness. Isn't this wonderful? As one dog speaks to another load of dogs, Christ says, we can come in. If we feel our sin, if we realize our unworthiness, we're welcome to come in. And it is faith that grasps onto Christ's willingness to reach out to the Canaanite woman. Remember what he said here? Matthew said, behold, a Canaanite. And you put these two things together. Uncleanness is from within. It's not defilement from outside. It's defilement from inside. Let's go to Tyre's side and let's meet this Canaanite woman. And Jesus says, that's what I'm meaning. She's in and the Pharisees are out. That's what I'm meaning. And that gives us, as Gentiles, great hope. Well, much more briefly, let me just move over these next two sections, which I think just underline the main point that's already being made. Christ's heart now for Gentile crowds. No balance in the length of my points this morning. But I just want to see, look at the first one. As Jesus goes on, with Gentile crowds, if we compared with Mark, we haven't got time, but we would see he's again in a Gentile region. He went on from there and walked beside the Sea of Galilee, but in a Gentile region, up on the mountain, sits down, verse 30, great crowds, Gentiles come, lame, blind, crippled, mute, and many others. Again, we're not talking about someone who's just a credulous fool. He's quite precise. Look at verse 31. What do the mute do? The mute speak. What are the crippled? The crippled become healthy. The lame walk. The blind see. And here's a significant point. What's Matthew's point? He's built up to it as he built up in the previous section. They glorified the God of Israel. The Gentiles say, there's only one God that I can come to, and it's the God of Israel. He has all the glory. And it's Christ saying, the God of Israel is also the God for the Gentiles. They can come in and they can be healed. It's not just the odd one. It's not just this Canaanite woman. We might think, well, I haven't got faith like her. Incredible faith. Christ says, I'm healing many. They glorify the God of Israel. He said, Gentiles can come in. And just to confirm that, he feeds Gentiles as well as Jews. Now, it's one of the laziest attempts to deny the miracle of Christ's miraculous feeding to say, well, it's just all kind of a bit Chinese whispers and there's various stories. And then we can say to them, if you're thinking that, well, how come in this Chinese whispers view does Matthew happen to have two separate feedings in the same gospel? It's not separate stories. He's put them both together. And he's got the feeding of the 5,000 Jews. And now we've got a feeding of 4,000 Gentiles and different numbers of loaves and fish. And when you might say, well, this just seems to be the same thing again, when the disciples say, where are we going to get enough bread in such a desolate place, verse 33, to feed so great a crowd? Then the disciples may well be thinking, well, I can understand the new Moses coming along and feeding the Jews. But Jesus, these are Gentiles. Have you not seen who's around you? These aren't your people. These are the Gentiles. And Jesus says, they're to be fed too. And so again, it's just confirming. This is the foretaste of the marriage supper of the Lamb. This indiscriminate welcoming of the Gentiles. He's not saying just for certain Gentiles. It's 4,000. Once again, we see it recorded at the end, verse 38. 4,000 men besides women and children. Christ's heart for the Gentile crowds. They can come in too. And surely this passage, as we draw this together, is in some way a commentary or an illustration of John chapter 1. He came to his own, and his own did not receive him. That's what was happening with the Pharisees. They rejected him. But to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. He welcomes them all in. It's a wonderful encouragement. But let me just say in closing, if you today have not come to him, that the welcome is not enough. It's not enough, is it? It's not enough to have the invitation unless you go and attend the wedding. It's not enough to have a doctor who can heal you if you don't go to the surgery. It's not enough to have someone who's willing to answer your prayers if you never cry out to him in faith. So let me encourage you this morning. Come to him like this woman, saying, I have nothing, but you have everything. I bring you my sin, and I will receive your forgiveness and your righteousness. The offer is there for you this morning. If you're a Gentile, Christ's arms wide open to heal, to forgive, to welcome you into his family. If you're a believer this morning and you, to be honest, if someone asks you, didn't say, how are you? And then you'd say, fine. And then they'd say, well, how really are you? And then you, and if you're honest, you might say, well, to be honest, I'm struggling. I'm finding things hard. I'm not quite sure of a lot of things. Well, why not meditate on Christ and that woman? You might say, well, it just feels I'm in this place where there was no answer, or there was a distant answer. You can look at this story and say, Christ, too wise to be mistaken, too good to be unkind. He acted in this way to draw out this woman's faith. He didn't push her beyond the point beyond which he was capable. He didn't push her that far. But he acted in a way to draw out her faith, that she might know the joy of trust and reliance on her. And when we get to heaven and get to meet this woman, she is not going to say, he is unkind. She's going to say, I cannot believe that Matthew, through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, showcased my faith in this way. But I'm glad he did, because it encourages all believers to say, we can trust him. Too wise to be mistaken, too good to be unkind. Amen.